And away we go on this Monday, April 29th, 2019, 4/29/19, last Monday in April, 15 minutes past the hour. And we have got a great program, great week of programming here for you on WWGH Radio. Going to take a minute and let you know what's coming up this week before I get to our guests this hour, which you are not going to want to miss. Coming up on Wednesday from 1:15 to 2 p.m. on this program, we're going to be joined by the Ohio Democratic Party Chairman, David Pepper. We have not talked to him since the big elections last November, in which the Democrats did not do too well. Going to talk to him about the upcoming elections and all the things that have been going on nationally and statewide here in Ohio. David Pepper, Democratic National Chairman, or Democratic State Chairman of Ohio, Wednesday, 1:15 to 2 p.m. Coming up in hour number two today, are you a fan of classic radio or classic television? Well, hour number two today is going to be an hour you don't want to miss, because we are going to be joined by the daughter of quite possibly the most famous person in the history of radio, and quite possibly the most famous person in the history of the early days of television preceding 1960. The daughter of Jack Benny and Mary Livingston, Joan Benny, joins us next hour to remember her father and mother, who was very well known as well. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun. A first-time visitor to this program, but I hope not a last-time visitor. You probably remember him from his many appearances, I think over 20, on the Johnny Carson Show. He was also on with Merv Griffin, Jack Parr, Ed Sullivan. Time Magazine referred to him as the Yoda of memory training. What a pleasure to welcome to these microphones today to learn about our memories, magic, and a look back at his life, the magical memory expert, Harry Lorraine. Harry, how are you?
I'm okay. I think on a scale of 10, about a 6.
How's the weather where you are, Harry?
Well, right now it's sunny, but I live in New England. The weather here is crazy. It could be sunny as it is right now, and an hour or two it could be raining. So there's no way to know. But right now it's fine.
Harry, I want to get into this interview because what an interesting life you've led, and I want to talk a lot about this memory, but I want to know about your growing up days. Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like?
Oh, boy. It was not a great childhood, Scott. I was born on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in New York. It was a ghetto. I didn't know that word at that time, but that's what it was. It was just awful. I'm an original dead-end kid. If you know New York at all, I was born right off the East River, as I say, on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And it was a very poor neighborhood, and my parents were professional poor people. I mean, everybody there was poor, but they were the best, my mother and father. We were very poor. I had a terrible upbringing.
How did their poor economic circumstance impact your life?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. You know, you have to understand something, Scott. I'm 93 years old, so that when I was a kid, there was no television. I thought that the whole world was that way, the way we lived. So, we did the best we could. It's as I grew older and learned differently and learned that the world was really, generally speaking, a better place than where I was, that it started to bother me. But when I was a child, like I say, I thought the whole world was that way.
When you were growing up in this economically deprived circumstance and in this ghetto area, what did you want to be? What did you want to be when you were able to be on your own?
Oh, boy, I didn't have thoughts like that. I just, I guess in those days you just wanted to get through each day. I was the shyest kid in the world. I mean, I got that from my mother. She, if she was on a railroad track and a train was coming, she'd be too shy to yell help, I was too shy to raise my hand when I was in kindergarten, I guess. Oh, God, I was too shy to raise my hand when I had to go to the bathroom, I mean, I really was the shyest kid in the world, so I didn't have any aspirations, really, at that time. The world changed for me afterwards, but to answer your specific question, I just wanted to get through each day.
When did magic enter your life?
Well, you see, that's an important question. I was about 10 and a half years old, 11 years old, and like I say, I lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and there was a park called, we called it Pitt Street Park, across the street from Hamilton Fish Library, and I and a few of my friends used to go to this park after school almost every day, because they had a shuffleboard layout, and there was a counselor there who would teach us shuffleboard and paddle tennis and things like that. But one day, and talk about a pivot point, it was raining, so the counselor had to take us all indoors, and I guess he didn't know what to do with us, so he showed us a card trick. And that changed my life, because as I sat there and watched it, I kept saying to myself, oh, if I could only do that. My God, if I could only do that. But, of course, I was too shy to go to the counselor and ask him how he did that card trick. Of course, I also didn't realize that no magician's going to tell you how he did the trick anyway. But that didn't matter, because I was too shy to ask him. That changed my life, because I went home thinking about that trick. This is interesting. I stole a few empty milk bottles. I lived in a tenement building, a walk-up. I lived on the fifth floor. And in those days, people would have bottles of milk, the old-fashioned, you know, with cream on top, that kids would drink before the parents shook the bottle, you know. And they would put the empty bottles outside their door so that the milkman would take, let's say if he saw two empty bottles, he would take those two and replace them with two full bottles. Anyway, if you took them to the grocery store, they were, it's a little vague in my mind, it was either 2 cents a bottle or 3 cents a bottle. Anyway, I stole enough bottles to buy a deck of cards, which I think was about 18 cents at the time, so I could try to figure out this trick that the counselor had done for us. And I did. I figured out four or five different ways to do it, one or two of them better than he did. And as I said, that was a pivot point. Jack, that changed my life.
What is the secret? Because I've seen a lot of magicians, and I would qualify some as good and some as not so good. What's the secret to being a good magician?
You know, my two areas of expertise are card magic and memory. And in both areas, I've seen people do very good card magic, but bore the heck out of their audience. And over the years, I've had, oh my gosh, I lost count of how many people tried to imitate me because they learned all my memory systems, because I teach that in my books. I've written 30 books on the subjects, for God's sakes. So I teach how to do the memory, and I've caught people in my audiences when I was doing appearances with a notebook, you know, copying down every word I said, etc. And the reason I'm telling you this, I've seen very good cardmen and people who learned my memory systems bore the heck of their audiences. So to answer your specific question, and I've written about this, I've talked about it, I've done seminars on it, magic and memory are my areas of expertise. They are my media. But I am basically an entertainer. That's the key. That's the answer to your question. I don't care if you sing, dance, tell jokes, flap your arms and fly around the room. If you don't make people laugh, if you don't, then here's the key word. If you don't entertain them, then you're not doing the right thing. That's it. You're not really doing what you're supposed to be doing.
How does a shy kid become a good entertainer in front of people?
Well, that's another good question. You know, I had to get over that. One of the most difficult things, it's funny what comes to mind, one of the things I do, you know, I've done it for, oh my gosh, what is it, 70 years now, is the first thing I do when I appear for an audience is I call off the names of everybody in the audience. In other words, I remember the names of up to 1,000 people, pointing out to each person as I call their name, etc. And when you say, how does a shy kid, the most difficult thing for me when I first started was most of the appearances I was making were at dinner functions. In other words, people were having dinner, and I was their speaker or entertainer after dinner. Well, I had to approach. I had to meet the people. That's how I remembered their names. You know, I had to meet them at first. The most difficult thing for me to do at first was to approach a table cold and ask the people to give me their names. Of course, as time went by and I became a bit known, then it became easier. Then it got to the point where when I was at one table, people at the other table would say, hey, Mr. Lorraine, aren't you going to remember our names? In other words, the whole situation changed then, and I got over my shyness. A lot of people, some people who have written about me, say that I overcompensated, and I did, Scott. I really was the shyest person in the world, and I overcompensated. So people don't consider me shy anymore.
Well, it's so interesting because I know there are so many shy kids possibly listening right now or will hear this in the future, and they think, how can I do that? How can I get on stage? That's a big leap for a lot of people.
Well, it was a tremendous leap for me, but you know, like I said, I've been very lucky in my life. I'm knocking wood mentally. These things worked for me. I mean, when I learned card magic, what happened was, let's go back to where I learned that one trick that I saw the counselor do with a deck of cards. Well, it's like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody is there, does it make a sound? Well, it's the same here. If you learn to do a trick and you never show it to anybody, are you doing a trick? I mean, you know, somebody's got to see it. That, again, when I say pivot point, that's what I mean. That changed my life. I learned a trick. Okay, great. What happens now? Well, I got to show it to somebody. So, you know, I was the kind of kid, when I say I was shy, I never made eye contact. I never spoke to anybody unless they spoke to me first. But now, I had to say at least three words. I had to say, pick a card. Otherwise, how am I going to do the trick? And again, as I say, that started to change my life because I started to do this trick starting with the first three words, pick a card. I started to show it to a lot of my friends, and before you know it, they were saying, hey, Harry, can you show us another trick? Well, I didn't know another trick. I only knew this one. I ended up going to the library, doing research, etc., trying to find other tricks. So again, forgive the redundancy, that was a pivot point. That changed my life. And that took away a lot of the shyness. I had no choice anymore. I had to make eye contact. I couldn't look at somebody's belly button and say, pick a card. So, as I say, that changed my life.
Harry, you were on some of the great talk shows with some of the great talk show hosts that there has ever been. I want to run down a few of these. Give me your memories of being on the show, and give me your memories of the host themselves. And we'll start with Ed Sullivan.
Boy, Ed Sullivan. Excuse me. I did the Ed Sullivan a couple of times show. There's an interesting story behind that, probably more interesting than the others. I was dropped from the show. I was booked for it a number of times. I was living in Long Island somewhere at that time. This is many years ago. It's like 1960-something. And they would have me come in and stay at a hotel in Manhattan, not far from the Ed Sullivan Theater. So I would be near there, and they'd bring me in with my wife the night before, etc. But a lot of times I was bopped, what they called bopped from the show, because somebody would come in from Europe that they had to put on, and they didn't have room for me. So I was bopped About three or four times. But in those days, I don't know how it is now, I got $1,500 each time I was canceled. Well, okay, you know, $1,500, that was a lot of money. And I didn't have to do anything, and I had a nice stay at a hotel overnight, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, finally, Ed Sullivan's son-in-law, who was the producer of the show, got me on. Didn't bop me one time. I was there, and we went to, I had to go to rehearsal, and there were about 400 people. It was an audience of about 400 people. And what happened, you had to go there for rehearsal, and the singers were rehearsing, and the comics were rehearsing. Ed Sullivan used to do that, you know. He used to listen to each comic with a notepad in his hand, and he would interrupt them and say, no, you can't. I remember him saying one of the comics used the word pregnant in a joke he was telling, and Ed Sullivan said, no, you can't use that word. It was a little bit of a different world then, Scott. Anyway, this is rehearsal, and I met the 400 people in the audience, and I called off all their names, and I got a standing ovation. It was terrific. And then after the rehearsal, which lasted over an hour, most of the acts went to get made up, you know, get the makeup on and grab a drink or something. And I was about to do that too when I saw all the people in the audience get up and start to leave. Long story short, it seems that they had a different crowd for rehearsal that came for the regular show, and I had just met 400 people. Well, I had to stay there. We ran outside. There was another line of the second 400 people that I had to meet for the show. So that's part of my Ed Sullivan experience. And Ed Sullivan was very nice. When I finally did the show, I have a picture on my wall, as a matter of fact, with his arm around me saying great things and how wonderful I was and all that. So that kind of answers your question about Ed Sullivan.
Let's talk about Jack Parr.
Oh, there's another. Oh, God, you're picking some goodies here. When I first started to get known and started to work, I could not get the Jack Parr show. For some reason, there was a guy who ended up becoming the vice president at ABC eventually, but he kept calling me. We became on a first name basis because we talked so often, but I couldn't get booked on the show. And finally, this guy said to me, Harry, look, I hate to tell you this, but we were at a meeting, as we have, you know, to figure out our next show, blah, blah, blah. And I mentioned your name, and Jack Parr slapped the table and said, would you leave me alone with Harry Lorraine already? In other words, I can't mention your name to him anymore. Why that happened, I don't know. I didn't know Jack Parr. He didn't know me, but that's what was happening. Okay, now we get into another whole story here. I broke in doing my memory demonstration, my memory act, with my wife. We did it for 20 years all over the world at the Catskill area in New York State. And one time at a show, Morse Hart, who was very famous at the time, he had written a book called Act One, and he was one of the directors or producers of My Fair Lady, the very famous Broadway show. Anyway, he was there with his wife, and when I ran around, the way I used to do it at the hotels is I would meet the people at dinner. I would walk around, as I told you, to each table, meeting all the people, whether they were known people or not, some of the famous people. This was at a hotel called Grossinger's, and they would sit way in the back up on sort of a little balcony. Anyway, I had to meet them to let them know I met them. And now, about an hour later, or 2 hours later, comes the showtime. Now I'm in the main theater backstage getting ready, and somebody comes running back and says, oh, Mr. Lorraine, Morse Hart is in the audience with his wife. I said, oh, that's nice. It seems that Morse Hart came to Grossinger's very often, you know, to relax, whatever reason, but he never went to the show. But he came to see me. That's why this person came running in all excited, saying, oh, Morse Hart is in the audience. Okay. Anyway, I do my show, et cetera, et cetera. And we had to drop, my wife and I had to drive home that night because I had a show in New York City the next day. Usually we stayed over, you know, because they treated me as a very special guest and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I had to drive home that night, but we wanted to grab a cup of coffee before we left. So we're in the room that they used after showtime for people, you know, to have coffee or a late dinner or whatever. And my wife and I are having coffee, and a waiter comes over and says, Mr. Lorraine, Morse Hart would like you to join him at his table. Morse Hart and his wife were sitting with another couple, and I said, of course. So we went over there, and we got very friendly, and we talked, and et cetera. And when I finally said, you know, we've got to leave you folks, I got to drive home, Morse Hart turned to me. This is very difficult for me to, I'm getting a little emotional. Give me a minute.
We're chatting with
Morse Hart turned to me and said, Harry, you have given me an evening I'll never forget. Is there anything I can do for you? And without thinking, I said, yeah, get me on the Jack Paar show. And my wife kicked me under the table. I think I still have the black and blue mark. And anyway, he said, Harry, do this for me. And he gave me his card with his home address on Park Avenue in New York. And he said, I want you to send me a letter telling me what you could do on a Jack Paar show, basically remembering the names of everybody in his audience, and send that to me, okay? And I said, of course. And anyway, we left driving home. My wife said to me, you're really going to send Morse Hart a letter? I said, yeah, what if I got to lose a nickel? I mean, it was 5 cents to send a letter in those days. And again, to make a long story short, I get a call from this guy that I've been talking to who was the talent guy for Jack Paar, and he said, Harry, what are you doing next Tuesday? And I said, I think I'm going to be finally on the Jack Paar show. And he said, yeah. He said, do you know what happened? I said, yeah. Morse Hart sent Jack Paar the letter I sent him. He said, no. Morse Hart brought it to Jack Paar and said, if you don't put this guy on your show, I will never do your show again. Mm. So that's my Jack Paar story.
What a great story. That is a great
story. Yeah, I get, you know, it happened so many years ago, and I still get emotional over it, that Morse Hart, who is such a famous person, certainly compared to what I was at the time, to do this for me. He had been doing only the Jack Paar show, plug in his book. Like I told you, he had just written a book called Act One, which was it was on a bestseller list all over the country and so forth and so on. For him to do that, to say that to Jack Paar, was something I'll never forget.
You know, it's very interesting, Harry. One of the people we had on this program over 35 times was Phyllis Diller. Hugh Downs was a regular guest for many years on this show. Hugh Downs was Jack.
Who, Hugh Downs?
Hugh Downs, yeah. Who was Jack Paar's?
Yeah, I knew him, sure.
Yeah, Jack Paar's announcer. And they all,
right.
And Phyllis, who was on Jack Paar's show all the time, they all loved Jack, but they all found him a little different. How did you find the man when you were finally on the show?
He was not my favorite person. He was the first person I ever saw when I did his show. First of all, let me tell you, when I did his show, I was backstage, and Jack Paar was a pacer, as I am, and he was a cigar smoker, so he's smoking a cigar, pacing back and forth, and as I am, so we kept crossing each other, and he finally stopped, and he said, listen, pal, I'm going to give you only about 5 minutes, so only remember about 7 or 8 people in the audience. And I said, yes, sir, you know, now I'm going to remember 5, 6 people. I mean, that's what he said to me, and he called me pal. Now when the show actually came on and I got on the show, I remembered everybody in the audience, 400 people. Now he finally introduces me, and we talk for a minute, and again he calls me pal, and I call him Mr. Paar, and he really gives me only 6 minutes, and he says, okay, Harry, let's see what you can do. And a man was ready with a handheld microphone. I get up, I say, with all the people in the, with the few, I always said, with the few people and the audience who gave me their names earlier this evening, would you please stand? Well, 400 people stood up, and I saw Jack Parr turn white under his makeup, you know? He thought I was nuts. I run into the audience, and of course, I'm a fast speaker, as you can see, but I only had 5 minutes left, and I wanted to call out everybody in that audience, which I ended up doing. It was sort of an elevated audience. In other words, I had to go upstairs as I got closer to the people standing, and I called all the people, and as I got to the top, there were maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 10 more people standing, and I heard Mr. Parr calling me, "Mr. Lorraine, we got to close the show. You got to come down here. Come on back." And as I started to walk back to the desk, I called off the few remaining people who were still standing. And as I reached Pa's desk, he actually said, "Amazing," 3 times. I know that because we did a brochure after that, and on the front page was a picture of me on Jack Parr's show saying, "Who made Jack Parr say amazing, amazing, amazing?" You know. So, but that's what happened on the show. But I started to tell you before, he was the first person I ever saw. We're in an elevator with Mr. Parr going home, I guess, and there are a few other people in the audience, and there was a man in the elevator with us who was a fan of Jack Parr, I guess, and he sticks out his hand, "Oh, Mr. Parr, I'm a big fan, I love your work," and Parr just left him with his hand sticking out. He didn't take his hand. It's the first time I ever saw that. So I didn't know of that well, but that gives you a general idea, I guess.
Mm. Very interesting. Johnny Carson. We got to get to Johnny Carson.
Well, Johnny Carson became a good friend. Johnny, even when I wasn't doing his show, when I was in Los Angeles, I would call him and we would get together. He and I, we used to go to dinner together, or we'd play cards with Steve Martin and other people. Of course, they all always said to me, "Harry, if you touch the cards, we'll kill you." You know. But Johnny Carson and I became very friendly. And whenever I wrote a book, and I always told my publisher to contact Johnny, to contact the Tonight Show, he never turned me down. He always said, when I came out with a new book, "Absolutely, you come on the show and talk about your new book." So we became personal friends.
A lot of people say he was difficult to know. How did you find the man?
You know, that's interesting because a few people said that to me also. And he was never difficult with me. It was just the opposite. He was very nice to me. Like I say, even if I wasn't doing his show, most of the time, don't forget I lived in New York, so we're talking about, you know, coast to coast. But occasionally I would be doing an appearance for a corporate group somewhere there, and I always would call Johnny because he asked me to and say, "Let me know when you're in town." And even when I wasn't doing his show, he would say, "When you finish your appearance, Harry, come meet me at such and such." We'd sometimes go to the Magic Castle because, you know, Johnny was interested in magic also. He started as not really as a magician. He started when he lived in Nebraska as a young man. He started as a ventriloquist. He wanted to do ventriloquism, and he did a little magic, so he was kind of interested in the kind of work that I did.
Mm. Very interesting. Harry, we talked about being a magician. How did memory become such a big part of your life?
Oh, boy, here's another pivot point. Scott, you're asking some good questions here. I thought that magic would be my life, would be my career. And I started to do it professionally. And I ended up, got to remember, I was very young. When I was 19 years old, approximately, I was doing what they call table magic. In other words, going from table to table in a club called Billy Reed's Little Club in New York City. It was on near 55th Street off Park Avenue. And I was doing, you know, going from table to table. You work for tips. I had a choice. They said, do you want to be paid each table or do you want to work for tips? I found out working for tips was much better. Good example, Frank Sinatra used to come in to see me, and Sinatra carried only $100 bills. So when he tipped me, it was a $100 bill, okay? So working for tips was in those days, for me anyway, in that stage of my life, was better. Anyway, I thought this was going to be my life, and I'm doing table magic there, and one day, an actor by the name of Victor Jory, who was very well known at the time, he played Helen Keller's father in the movie called Miracle Worker. That was way back in 1962. Anyway, he was a pretty well-known guy, and he was interested in magic. As a matter of fact, the reason that he was in New York, he was rehearsing a show that he had written where he was a detective. He was the the star of the show. He was a detective who did magic. So he was kind of interested in magic. So anyway, he came into the little club with a friend, and they asked for me. The way it worked at the little club, there was a card on each table, and it said you could ask for Harry Lorraine, the Magic Ten. They called me the Magic Ten, meaning the Magic Ten Fingers, okay? And you had to ask the maitre d' or the waiter, we would like to have Mr. Lorraine come out to our table, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, Victor Jory did, and I did my thing. I had certain set routine to do at each table. And about a week later, he comes in with another friend. To make a long story short, he kept coming in a couple of days later, a week later, each time with a different friend because he wanted that friend to see what he could do. But I was the kind of, I guess, like I say, when I overcompensated for my shyness, my ego, I wanted to do at least one trick that Victor Jory hadn't seen yet, okay? Well, that's what I did each time. But you got to remember, I was 19 years old. I had a finite number of tricks I could do. Now I can go on for, you hand me a deck of cards, I can go on forever. I make it up as I go along, but not way back then. So, the reason I'm telling you that, I ran out of tricks to show Victor Jory, and the only other thing remaining, and I was interested in memory at the time, and mostly with cards. I was able to remember a deck of cards, if you called them off real quick, a shuffle deck of cards, etc., etc. So, the only thing left, and to me, it was like scraping the bottom of the barrel, I did a memory stunt for Victor Jory. And again, as I said before, talk about a pivot point. When I finished it, he stood up, he started to applaud, and he said in a loud voice, so everybody at the little club, because it was a little club, could hear him, he said, Harry, all the sleight of hand with cards that I've seen you do all these weeks was terrific, marvelous, but what you just did, and he started to rave about the memory. And that, to answer your original question, how did I segue from magic to memory, that changed my life. I said, I realized, wow, I didn't think it was that important. So as I say, that changed my life.
Well, Harry, this is important because you talked about going on Jack Parr's show and remembering the names of people in the audience. It made Jack Parr say amazing three times. I remember you doing that on Johnny Carson's show as well. Now, most people listening and myself would say, there's no way we could do that. How do you do it?
Of course there's a way you could do it. The way I wrote about 29 books, for God's sakes. And as I told you before, I had people imitating what I did because I teach how to do it. I'm not going to sit here and teach it to you, but what I taught were a couple of things. First of all, the first thing you have to do is make a name meaningful. All memory is based on the reminder principle. And you have to be reminded of a name. In other words, when I say all memory is based on the reminder principle, a face reminds you of a name. A foreign word reminds you of the English equivalent word, and so forth and so on. What I teach, basically, the first thing, what I'm teaching how to remember names anyway, because it's different to remember numbers, it's different to remember foreign language, although foreign language falls kind of into the same category. A foreign language word, if you don't know it, like a name, if you don't know it, is a conglomeration of sound. A conglomeration of sound is the most difficult thing to remember. You've got to make it meaningful in your mind. So the first thing you got to do, as I say, is take any name and make it meaningful. I'm trying to think of an easy example as I'm talking to you, Scott. All right. Bentivania. I met a Mr. Bentivania years ago. Now, I think that's a fairly common name in Italy, but I had never heard it before. How in the world can I visualize? There's the key word. You know, somebody wrote years ago in a book, because I did a heck of a lot of research when I got into this, and the first word in the book on thinking, on using your brain and all, was, in order to think, we must speculate with images. And that's what all memory is about. You're speculating with images. You're seeing it in your mind. How in the world can I visualize, how can I make Bentivania meaningful? Well, you know something? It's kind of easy. Break down the sounds. I saw, using this as an example, I saw a bent weather vane. You know, the thing that's got N-E-W-S on it, northeast, west, south. It's called a weather vane. Well, I can visualize that, and I can see it bent. Bent vane. There's my reminder. Excuse me. I get so emotional, you know. Okay, so now think about this. And this is what most people don't realize, and I've written about it often enough. I have said in most every one of my books, even if my systems don't work, they must work. Now, there's a contradictory statement, but pay attention to this for a moment, which I find very difficult to get through, usually, to people, not to you, Scott, obviously. But when I say, even if my systems don't work, if you try to do what I just told you, listening, and here's the key word, Bentivania, first of all, you had to do something that you very rarely do. And that is listen to the name. How in the world can you come up with, like in this example, bent vein to remind you of Bentivania if you don't make sure that you hear the name? That's key, okay? Because most people, you're at a party, you're introduced to somebody, you don't even listen. You're looking over their left shoulder to see who else is in the audience, in the room, to impress, okay? So Just trying to do what I just told you forces you to listen to hear the name. Now, not only that, you're thinking about the name, trying to come up with the kind of vision that I just told you about, like a bent weather vane to remind you of Bentivania. And that's what I mean, that even if the systems didn't work, they gotta work. You just concentrated on something like you never had before without pain, okay? Now that's the first step. The second step is to tie what you just thought of, in this example, a bent vane, to the person's face. Well, how do you do that? Well, simple. Pick an outstanding feature. I don't care what it is. When I teach this to front of audiences, when I'm doing a seminar, I have people look at my face and I say, pick out the outstanding feature to you, and I'll get 10 different answers. The creases in your forehead, the size of your ears, the size of your nose, whatever. I don't care. It's what you see, because the important point is, in order to pick an outstanding feature, you got to do something that most people don't do, like they don't listen, and that is they don't look. Look at the person's face. So again, you're making an impression that ordinarily you don't bother with. Well, in order to pick an outstanding feature, you got to look at that face. So you've had to listen. to come up with a bent vein. You've had a look to pick, let's say, the Mr. Bentivania's big nose. That's the outstanding feature to you. That's one and two. Now here comes the third important step. It's called association. Tie the two together. Associate them. How? I look at the person's face, and incidentally, I'm talking for, 5 minutes about this? In action, it's seconds as I'm shaking the person's hand. I see a bent weather vane on Mr. Bentivania's face instead of a nose. That's it. The next time I see Mr. Bentivania, I see that big nose, I see a bent vane there, I say, hi, Mr. Bentivania, how are you?
Harry, it's fascinating because, you know, I remember being in high school and college, and essentially there were a lot of classes I had to take, and a lot of people do, that they are never going to think about that stuff again, but they got to pass a test, and they've got to remember the answers. Now, does that work? Does this work for that as well as people and names and things like that?
It works for everything, Scott, in all my years. And, you know, I can say that. I told you before, I'm 93 years old, so I've been doing this, my gosh, for 70 years or more. And I've seen it all. At seminars, people come up with things that I didn't understand myself, but I can remember them. In my very first book, my gosh, I'm going back to 1956, I taught. And I don't know if this is the kind of example that will fit what you just asked me, Scott, but I taught how to remember the Morse code, because to most people, the Morse code is just, again, meaningless. How do you visualize dots and dashes, for God's sakes, and the alphabet? Well, I put it in there because somebody asked me about it at the time I was writing the book, and I came up with a system that it... I'm told people all over the world now use, and I'm going back to 1956. And what a simple idea. I said, let's make the dot, let's give the dot a letter, R, let's give the dash a letter, T, RT. Well, now I can visualize dots and dashes. Whereas never, here comes visualization again, which is the key, as I told you, to all memory. We must speculate with the images in my mind. So if I want to remember that A, and I can remember A, you know why? Because it sounds like ape, and I've done that for every letter in the alphabet. Of course, ordinarily, you're not going to be able to visualize a letter, but if I give it a vision that is familiar to you, like an ape, you can visualize an ape, and I see a rat jumping on that ape, I visualize this silly picture of this gigantic rat jumping on an ape. I've got the two important things I need. Ape, A, rat, dot, dash. That's it.
That's fascinating. It's just, Harry, we're down to the final 3 minutes here, so you've got to promise to come back in the future because we're just scratching the surface here. But tell
people... That's for sure.
Tell people what your most recent book is and books you would recommend that they can still go out and purchase.
Boy, you know, that's a good question. Let me do a little plug here. Go to Harry Lorraine. That's spelled L-O-R-A-Y-N-E, no double R, L-O-R-A-Y-N-E. So go to harrylorainemagic.com, click on store, and then click on memory books, because there are a lot of choices. I've written 29 books on card magic also. So if you're interested in that, fine, you click on that. But for the memory books, click on that, and you'll see which are currently available. My most current is called Ageless Memory. It was originally called the Over 40 Memory Book. In other words, it's the same basic systems that I've taught in all my books, but this is geared a little more towards people with gray hair like mine, okay? How to remember the names of the pills you have to take, how to remember whether you took one what you're supposed to or didn't. So there's the memory, there's Ageless Memory, there's the Memory Book, which was on the bestseller list of the New York Times for a couple of years. There's a book called The Page a Minute Memory Book, among others. So there are your choices, and it explains each one.
Harry, before we go here, we got about a minute and a half left. What would you say to somebody right now, who's listening to this interview? What could they do today, one easy thing, to improve their memory?
Well, you know, I've already said it, so it's going to sound redundant. Learn to listen and look. Very simple. It's called paying attention. Most people don't pay attention. I've seen this so often. I've had a party or a meeting or a dinner affair, and one person is introduced to the other, and that person is looking over the introducer's shoulders, as I said before, trying to see who they can impress, who is more important to impress in this room, little knowing that the person that you're talking to right now is the most important person in the room. So, you know, it boils down to paying attention. Let me tell you that if you try to apply my systems, it will better your observation, it will better your imagination, it will better your concentration. All those things go hand in hand.
Before we leave, Harry, and I said one word answer on this one. Could this help somebody, your techniques, who has a medical problem with memory?
Absolutely. And a lot of doctors have told me that it's helped people who are starting to move towards Alzheimer's. Now, you have to understand something, Scott, and this is important. I have 1 year of high school, so I'm not a doctor, and I'm not going to make these statements. I can only tell you what other doctors say. And talking about doctors, I'll give you a little, call it a joke, although it really happened, vignette, and then we can say goodbye, Scott. I'm talking to a doctor years ago. I wrote about this in a book. And we're talking about memory, how important it is. And he says to me, you know, Harry, and he points to his shelf. He's got hundreds of medical books on his shelf. And he says, so, you know, if I need to know something, I just come here to my library and I pick out the book. And I said, you know, Dr. Smith, if you got me on the table and you got me cut open and you see something you're not sure about, I would much rather that you remembered what to do rather than for you to run to your office and find the book to tell you what to do. So I think it's important to remember everything you have to remember in your area of life.
Harry Lorraine has been the guest, and he is going to come back with us. He is the Yoda of memory training. Time magazine gave him that title. And we also thank Mr. Bentivania and his big nose for Harry's appearance today. Harry, we'll talk soon.
Scott, it was my pleasure. I hope so.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Harry Lorraine, how about that? Joan Benny, Jack Benny, and Mary Livingston's only child. Next, my God, don't go anywhere.
But the issue that I saw with Chris, we've already had problems with the Tense logo. I think you know about this.